Hi, and welcome again to the Wealth of Experience podcast. I'm James Gruber, and as usual, I'll be joined by Graham Hand, Editor-at-Large for the First Links newsletter and Editorial Director at Morningstar, and Peter Warnes, Head of Equities Research at Morningstar Australasia and Editor of Your Money Weekly. We have an exciting episode for you this week. Graham will first discuss David versus Goliath. In this case, it's the Minnow ETF industry versus the giants of managed funds in Australia. Many people will be surprised to learn that the ETF industry is a minnow, yet that's part of Graham's point. He wants to set the record straight on why this misconception about ETFs exists. Meanwhile, Peter will look at where markets sit heading into the second half of this year. It was a stellar first half of 2023, especially for many overseas markets such as the US. Can that continue? We'll find out more from Peter. And lastly, our special guest for this week is Peter Thornhill. Peter is well known, especially among retail investors. He's an investment consultant and speaker and the author of the book Motivated Money. His investment strategy of holding quality industrial shares and LICs that produce consistent long-term dividend income has gained many thousands of followers. In the interview, we'll explore Peter's background, how he formed his investment philosophy, and why he's remained steadfast with it for the past 40 years. Please note that any advice in this podcast is general in nature, and it may not be right for you, because we've not taken into consideration your personal financial needs. Let's now turn to Graham Hand. Graham, welcome again.
Hi, James. Great to be back.
Graham, I've only worked with you for a relatively short time, and I've noticed that you're a fairly balanced person on the whole.
Yeah, that's me.
Though there are a couple of issues where your balanced persona becomes less so. And one of those is the widespread coverage that ETFs receive versus managed investment funds. Tell us why this is, Graham.
Oh, James, I don't think it's lack of balance. I think it's just a reality check. And you know, if you look at the ETF industry, it's done a fantastic job of promoting not only individual funds, but the whole industry. And that's because, you know, the industry started in Australia, seriously, maybe 10 years ago, a dozen years ago, and it had to find a place for itself in the industry. So to the credit of the providers, you know, the Vanguard, VanEck, BetaShares, BlackRock, they promoted ETFs as much as the funds. And so they've been able to get a profile for ETFs, which is commendable. And look, I invest in ETFs personally. There's a lot of great funds out there. But my point is that the incumbent, if you like, is the managed funds industry, is actually the Goliath to the David of ETFs. And I've been writing about this in First Links recently. So when an ETF says, you know, we got inflow in the month of like $50 million, let's just think about the numbers in our industry before we get too excited. And just to clarify things, because, you know, during this podcast, I'm going to be talking a lot of numbers. So $1 billion is 1,000 million, okay? And $1 trillion is 1,000 billion. And when you start talking about trillions of dollars, as we will, 50 million is a rounding error. So just to quote one statistic, the total amount of money in managed funds in Australia is 4.5 trillion, 4,545 billion. And the total amount in ETFs is about 150 billion. And so this industry with rightly high profile and getting a lot of attention is about 3% of the managed funds industry. And yet, if you read the Financial Review, if you read a lot of stuff, even in Morningstar and First Links, we talk a lot about ETFs and ETF flows and ETFs products. It's 3% of the market.
To clarify, what do you include as managed investment funds?
Yeah, so, you know, good question. There's a lot of categories here. And, you know, we'll talk about sort of platforms and funds and ETFs. And look, an ETF might be held by a fund which might be on a platform. So, you know, there's doubling up or tripling up there. But managed funds are sort of everything, if you like. It's the all of the money that's in superannuation. It's the money that is held by professional fund managers. So it's really the professional money in the Australian industry.
And say if the super fund does hold ETFs, which I'm sure most of them do, do they get double counted or are they singled out? How does that work?
So there would be a double counting there, but my point is, like, even if it's a double counting, so what, right? The ETFs are so tiny that if you think about, if you talk to, say, Mark Delaney, the CIO of Australian Super, he alone manages $300 billion. That's double the size of the entire ETF industry. Does Mark Delaney invest in ETFs? Maybe. Maybe he does a little bit at the edges for liquidity, but it wouldn't be a big part of his portfolio.
So the obvious question is why do ETFs get so much coverage?
Look, to their credit, I think that the marketing teams in these companies, they put a lot of effort into communicating with the media. They provide a lot of data. The products are listed. And so immediately when it's listed, it has a profile. They do sort of thematic funds quite well. And so, you know, you do a crypto or robotics, it sort of gets the headlines. Whereas the managed funds is this sort of thing in the background that if you're from a fund manager, you tend to promote your own fund. You don't promote the managed fund industry. I mean, can you think of any time you've read an article that says, you know, why you should invest in managed funds, right? But you frequently see articles of, you know, the advantages of ETFs. So it's this sort of, as I say, a Goliath in the background. And look, everyone roots for David.
Is it also partly that ETFs are primarily for retail investors, whereas managed funds are probably more institutional than retail?
No, I don't see that distinction at all, really. I think it's just it's focus and misunderstanding. So let's sort of look at what are the big managed funds. In fact, the vast majority of Australians invest the superannuation not through ETFs. They wouldn't know an ETF if they fell over it, right? The vast majority of retail investors just go in through either industry funds or retail funds. And, you know, we all know the big industry funds, the Australian Super, the Uni Super, the Rest, the, you know, Host Plus, Australian Retirement Trust. You know, these are all massive businesses with millions of members. And if you're looking at the flows of retail investment in Australia, that's where the action is. You know, it's not 40 million going into a crypto ETF. That's a fun story and we write them as well. But the action is in the managed fund industry.
We've talked about the size of each now. What about in future? What does the future hold for, say, ETFs versus managed funds in terms of growth?
Yeah, so fascinating subject, because if you look at the Treasury forecast for superannuation alone, currently that's a $3.5 trillion industry. So get our billions and trillions right here. That's a $3.5 trillion. The biggest part of that is the industry funds at about $1.1 trillion. And the SMSFs are about $900 billion, or getting towards a trillion. But that 3.5 is forecast by Treasury to go to about 10 trillion in 2040. Okay, that's only, you know, 17 years from now. So you can say, what's that 10 trillion going to look like in 2040? I would expect that the industry funds will continue to be the leaders. And by that time, these big guys, the you know, Australian Super, which currently has about 300, you know, they currently have 300 billion. They'll probably have a trillion in their own right, right? You know, this is serious stuff. These are big numbers. And you can imagine, you know, the CIO of Australian Super and the other big ones, they are then very influential in what does corporate Australia invest in.
Extremely.
ESG principles, remuneration of executives. You know, if you're the CEO of a leading Australian company, you better keep friendly with those guys because they'll own you. So that's industry funds. I think SMSFs will continue to do well. SMSFs is where the big balances are. Okay, so not big balances as in the total amount, but if you are an individual with 3 million, 5 million, 10 million, 20 million, you probably have your money in an SMSF. So as people get wealthier, as they head to retirement, you do see this switch out of industry funds where someone may have been for 30 or 40 years. They've now got a bit of money. They may be retiring and they say, well, wait a minute. I'm retiring. I can be pretty good at this stuff. Why do I pay someone else to do it? I can buy BHP, Commonwealth Bank, Woolies and Coles just as well as a fund manager. Why am I paying them? And the research on SMSFs and why SMSFs are opened is one is for control, but the other is I think I can do better myself. So that's not going to stop. People who become individually wealthy will turn to the SMSF industry. And, you know, I was looking at the SMSF data because there has been some coverage that SMSFs are going to decline, but, you know, there's now over 600,000 SMSFs, and we get about 25,000 SMSFs established every year. So it's still a thriving industry despite what people say. And then if you like, what I think will be the third part of this sort of future growth of superannuation are the retail funds. So these are, you know, the Colonial First State, the AMP, those sorts of things, who will continue to have a role in the world. But as you know, the banks are stepping back from financial advice. And so I do think that they'll come third.
Hmm. And on SMSFs, while we're on the point, do you think that the new $3 million super tax will impact numbers of SMSFs at all?
I don't think it will affect the actual number of SMSFs, but I do think it will affect the amount that people leave in their SMSF. So, you know, people who have $2 or $3 million will still say that's enough money for me to avoid a fee, even though something like an ETF or an index fund as a managed fund is a pretty inexpensive way of investing. But anyway, people would say I can do it myself. So that will still happen, but with the $3 million, with the extra 15% tax on over $3 million, as we covered in another podcast, there are now alternatives which come into play, and not only are these things like private investment companies where the tax rate may be only 25%, but they are not subject to this tax on unrealized gain. But one thing I should mention, which I've overlooked in the past, is that these stage three tax cuts have a 30% tax rate. If they, assuming they come through, which the government has said they're going to continue with them, they have a 30% tax rate all the way up to a personal income of $200,000. So if you think about someone who has been working and they've built up a good balance, they've opened in superannuation, they've opened an SMSF, they then stop working and live off their retirement savings. Well, they then don't have a high-paying job that's filling up that $200,000, right? They could take their money out of super, invest it in their own name, and up to $200,000, I'm not giving any tax advice here, but up to $200,000, they would pay a tax rate of 30% and not be subject to this unrealized gain calculation that the government's introducing for superannuation balances over 3 million. So my expectation, and you know, this 3 million tax is a couple of years away, but you know, we are talking about the future here. My expectation is that a lot of the money from over 3 million will find other homes, other ways, other vehicles to invest them in. And that will take the top off the growth of the balances of SMSFs, even though people will still keep their SMSF.
Let's move on to investment platforms. They're attracting a lot of money. What's behind that, Graham?
Yeah, this is another fascinating part of the industry that doesn't get the coverage it deserves. And so, you know, the big platforms are from BT, Commonwealth Bank, AMP, Macquarie, and then the wraps, like from, you know, Netwealth, Hub24, Premium, Insignia is another big one. Mercer is big in this space. And in itself, this sort of platform industry that we're talking about is a trillion-dollar industry as well. So who uses it? Well, if you run a financial advice business, you know, you might have 20 or 30 financial advisors. You'll have hundreds of clients, right? If you want to run an efficient business, you've got to have the same processes for all of your advisors and all of your clients. If every one of them came along and said, okay, so I've had a talk to you about my financial advice, and this is what our investments are going to look like. Okay, I'd like to go on the BT one, and I'd like to go on the first choice one. And if you run your business with 10 or 20 platforms, it'll be total chaos, right? You've got to keep a streamlined back office process that when you implement a portfolio for a client, it goes through your back office in a sort of very streamlined process. So most financial advice businesses will say, I'll have a primary platform where most of my clients, particularly the ones who are not particularly high net worth, they can sit on that platform. And then normally a business will have a secondary platform and maybe a third one, which does something maybe for high net worths, might be a bit more personalization. But that is the way a financial advisor runs its business. So if you're a client, you would probably get put onto a platform. You know, you see an advisor, they don't just say, you know, go and buy these six funds and good luck. You know, they actually set you up on a platform. It's part of the process. It's part of the administration. So platforms and financial advice are very closely aligned. Now, I'm not saying that's the only way platforms are used. If you wanted to go and open an account with First Choice or BT Wrap or Net Wealth or whatever, You may be able to do that. Some of them only actually operate through advisors. And so platforms have a good future. And again, we've been writing about this in First Links because we don't think it gets enough attention. As a fundamental part of making financial advice affordable and efficient for more people.
We'll have to leave it there, Graham. Thanks again for your time.
Great, James. It's been good to be part of Wealth of Experience.
Let's move on to our other regular guest, Morningstar stock market guru, Peter Warnes.
Peter, great to have you back on the podcast.
Always good to have a chat, James.
Given we've just passed the halfway mark of 2023, it's an opportune time to get your views on how markets are placed heading into the second half of the year. I'd like to first get your perspective on the economic picture for the world's largest economies, such as the US, Europe, and China first.
Yeah, James. I mean, all three will be slowing into the second half of this year. The US has performed fairly well in the first half. The GDP growth in both first and second quarters, positive, although I notice that the Atlanta Fed has just downgraded their second quarter estimate. So slowing in the US. Europe is in a technical recession. The last quarter of 2022 and the first quarter of 2023 were slightly negative, and I would anticipate possibly a further negative reading in the June quarter. And China, after bouncing out of the lockdown, 4.5% first quarter growth, and the premier has tried to support markets by saying that the second quarter will be higher than the first quarter. That could be difficult, although, sometimes people question the Chinese statistics and the validity of them. But they're on track, and that's what the authorities are saying, for a full year of around 5%, and that will require, quite meaningful growth in the second half.
Okay, well, let's first turn to the US. As you were saying, the economic data has been more positive of late. Does that mean the much predicted recession there is looking less likely now?
Well, not necessarily. As I've said on many occasions before, the reaction to and the impact of 12 or 13 interest rate hikes over a year has been delayed by certain factors, and we can talk about those later. But there is slowing, and a lot of the data is starting to indicate that they are slowing. The factory data shows that the manufacturing sector's in recession, if you like, or in contraction. It's being held up by the services sector, but again, the growth is weakening there. And as of last night, the markets are pricing a 96% chance of a recession in the US in 2023.
Wow, that's amazing. 96%.
Has
that ever happened before, do you know?
Well, I don't know, but I mean, it's only a prediction, and predictions are very, very difficult, particularly when you're talking about the future.
Look, if that many are on one side of the fence, it's probably best to take the other.
Outsiders do get up, but very rarely.
Let's go to Europe. Europe seems determined to increase rates even when economic data there has deteriorated markedly. Why do you think it's doing that?
Well, it's just a situation with inflation being higher than they would like it, and strangely enough, higher than anywhere else in the developed world.
Is that right?
Amazing. Yes. So they haven't, yes, it's starting to ease, but it's still too high. I mean, the core has still got a 6 in front of it. And don't forget that they haven't lifted rates as much as the other Western central banks. They've still got a 3 in front of them in terms of their official rate, or high 3. And we're shooting at 4.1, and the US has got a 5 in front of it. So they still have some work to do, but of course they've got to be a little. They did have an invasion on their doorstep, and so they had to tread carefully. But that's the reason. It's straight inflation.
Right, and on to China. It's doing the opposite of the rest of the world. It's been providing economic stimulus and cutting rates. but that hasn't translated into kickstarting economic growth as much as they'd like, as you mentioned before. Why do you think it hasn't been effective or as effective as they'd like?
Well, again, interest rates aren't the panacea of all concerns. It can't do all the job. And of course, the interest rate cuts have been quite marginal. They're in a transition trying to move their economy from one that's been focused on fixed asset investment exports to more focused on driving domestic consumption. It's their dual policy, if you like, is to still be aware of what's happening in the global sense. In other words, still there to cater for exports and international demand, but very, very, very focused now on getting that economy and the domestic part of that economy running at where it should be running. Quite a bit higher than it is. And I would suspect now that with the authorities wanting to achieve their target GDP growth for the current year and beyond, that you're going to see some fiscal stimulus added to the monetary policy easing. And I think it could be quite meaningful, so that fiscal stimulus will drive consumer spending, driving domestic consumption, and that will filter through to higher GDP growth rates in the second half and beyond. I think they've got a good chance, strangely enough, to get closer to 6 than 5.5 for the year.
That could be good for Australia.
Well, it's domestic consumption. It's not iron ore. See, they're trying to move away from fixed asset investment. All their infrastructure is brand spanking new. It's you know, all been done in the last 10 years, whereas the infrastructure of Europe, of US and Australia hasn't been moved for probably 40 years. And that's where they've got the drop on us, because their infrastructure is much, much more efficient than our infrastructure.
True enough. Now, where do you think then Australia is heading for the rest of this year and into 2024 in terms of its economy?
Well, again, it all turns on the households, and the households, as we well know, is 60 to 65% of GDP, and households are in a mess. Well, not all of them. I mean, you can't knock the people who are well off or those who haven't got debt, but they're going to continue to spend. But the 80-20 rule is still working. And the majority of the 80% are mortgagees or renters. And therefore, with inflation where it is and your spending power being diluted daily, a combination of the mortgage cliff, you know, facing you, staring you in the face, household consumption is going to be under pressure, and I would suggest that on a per capita basis, that household consumption will go into recession in 2023. So that, and I suspect that GDP growth per capita will also be in recession by the end of 2023. So the outlook for the economy, if you look at the consumer confidence and sentiment levels, you look at what's happening out there in terms of the cost of living, there is going to be a sharp fall in household consumption, or the rate of growth of household consumption will contract meaningfully, and that will mean that the economy will be under pressure. And I see a possibility of a technical recession before the June quarter of 2024.
That's not consensus, is it?
It's not consensus, but that's I can't see how we're going to avoid it.
So you're of the view that there's just been a lag effect between higher rates and the economic impact from them?
Well, absolutely. And that's what's caused that is in a normal situation, the interest rate rises we have had would have had a much, much more immediate impact on household consumption and consumption generally and demand. Why it hasn't happened this time around is that one, fiscal policy in 2020 and 2021 filled household pockets with savings. Two, they couldn't spend it, and that's why the savings ratio went to almost 24%. It's now 3.7%. And of course, the demand, latent demand that came out of that fiscal largesse was pushed the manufacturing sector and increased demand for labour. And so you've got record low unemployment coupled with a savings buffer that has allowed households to continue to spend. Those things are over. The savings are gone, and I expect unemployment to start rising.
Okay, let's switch it to markets now. I'm keen to hear your assessment of the US stock market after an incredible first half of the year.
Well, again, it was incredible. It with the cult following of AI drove the NASDAQ a fantastic rise of almost 32% in the second half versus a 5.1% decline in the first half. And the S&P 500 was up 16% versus just 1.4% in the first half. So this cult, narrow-focused, the Magnificent Seven, how can it possibly continue at that rate? Well, the answer is it can't. I would suspect that there's going to be a decoupling very, very shortly, and those things are going to come back and could come back quite meaningfully if, in fact, investors decide that the overvaluation of some of those stocks is too high. And if they're in the ETF market, the ETF computer-driven unwind could be quite nasty. So I think that you're going to see a much, much more subdued US market. Traditionally now, we do have a summer hiatus, if you like. It's usually quieter between now and early September, early October. And then they come back from holidays, as I said, early October. So a pretty subdued outlook for the US market with downside rather than upside potential.
What impact would that have on the Australian market? I assume that with banks struggling here, commodity prices down or not going anywhere in some cases, and industrials and tech really driving the Aussie market in the first half of the year. If they come back, then the Aussie market could be in trouble, couldn't it?
Well, I've said for a little while that I think the Australian market's probably going to go sideways. We had a good year last year, up 9.7% in the accumulation index, taking in so the total shareholder return, if you like, including dividends, up nearly 15%. I don't expect anything like that going forward. If it's half that, I'd be surprised, and I'm certainly thinking it's going to be lower than that. Upside, in my opinion, a maximum 7,500 on the ASX 200, and I wouldn't be at all surprised to see it closer to 7,000. before the end of the year. And I don't think in 2024, certainly in the first quarter, it's still going to be difficult because we are still going to be seeing house sales still under pressure, despite the fact that the Reserve Bank would be finished raising rates by then. But the lag effect will still be there, and don't expect rate cuts until well into 2024, because I don't think inflation is going to get back to where they would like it to be. And by the end of 2024, early 2025.
Should we expect any surprises in the upcoming reporting season then, Peter?
Well, the reporting season, it's going to be interesting. The second half results should be a little bit less than or worse than the first half, because the economy has been ebbing. Economic activity has been slowing since late 2022. And we'll be looking, closely at the management forecasts or outlook if they're brave enough to speak up. But going into 2024, the December half, in other words, the first half of fiscal 2024, is going to be more difficult than the second half of 2023. So, sequentially, you're going into a weaker period. You're going to be the second half of 2023 is going to be weaker than the first half, and the first half of 24 is going to be weaker than the second half of 23.
That about covers it for this week. Thanks again for your time, Peter.
Well, I'm sorry, I'm a bearer of pretty ordinary news.
No problem.
That was Morningstar's Peter Warnes. It's time to bring in special guest Peter Thornhill. As mentioned earlier, Peter's investment philosophy of buying LICs and industrial shares that produce consistent dividends over the long term has gained many followers. Peter, welcome to the Wealth of Experience podcast.
Thank you.
Now, you've had a long career in financial services and investments. Can you take us back to how you got into the industry?
It was by accident, largely, when I failed my last year at high school. My dad got me a job as an apprentice sewing machine mechanic in a factory in Collingwood in Melbourne. And after about 6 months, I decided I could cross that off the bucket list and applied for a job with National Mutual, the life insurance company in Melbourne, and got a job as a clerk. Stayed there until I met and married a lovely lady, and we decided we'd go on a working holiday. And to make a bit more money, I left and joined a General Motors dealership, signing up contracts and making twice as much as I was making. So we managed to get away on our holiday, which was going to be 18 months and turned out to be just under 18 years. And it was that apprenticeship in England where I sort of fell into the same thing. In fact, my first job in England was working for the same company as I worked for in Melbourne, National Mutual. They had an office in the city. And I sort of gravitated from there to a merchant bank and et cetera, et cetera.
And that evolved into investing. Tell us more about that.
Okay. When I was working at National Mutual, it was, as a clerk, pretty boring. So I wandered into an employment agency in the Strand in London and applied for a job with a merchant bank in the city. Anthony Gibbs and Sons, joined them as a clerk. And in 1973, there were devastating market crashes, global. And a lot of staff were shed at that stage. For some reason, they kept me on. And my task was looking after a lot of clients who were fairly badly damaged by the financial crisis at that time. And it was a really wonderful apprenticeship because it was tough times. And from there, I eventually got headhunted by some staff who had left at the time in 73 when the market fell over. they had joined a company called Henderson Unit Trust Management in London, and they invited me to become a regional manager for them, selling the product to advisors in the Midlands in England. So my wife and I upped stumps, moved to Kidderminster, opened an office in Birmingham, and proceeded to deal with the Midlands in England, some of their beautiful counties. Very successful up there for some reason. So they asked me to come back to London and take over London and the Southeast. In the process of doing that, S.G. Warburg, who were getting involved with Potter Partners, hence Potter Warburg. For some reason, I must have been mentioned in dispatches. So in the process of moving back to London with Henderson's, they asked me to come and work for them, which I did, and worked for them for a number of years. And then Perpetual Funds Management must have heard about me. They asked me to come to Sydney, where I did, and then successful there with Perpetual Funds Management, selling their wonderful industrial share fund. MLC rang me up and invited me in, and so it went on until 2000, when I reached the point where I was no longer comfortable telling people to do what fund managers were asking them to do, and I split and took up public speaking on my own account outside.
Okay, there are a lot of different threads to pick up there. I want to back it up to 1973. What lessons did you learn out of that as an investor and as an advisor?
Well, I wasn't an investor at that stage because I was basically a clerk, but because of the loss of staff, I was dealing with an awful lot of people who were investors with the company. So it was sorting out the issues associated with that.
Hmm.
And I just got immersed. The actual investment side of it was not top of pile for me. It was dealing with the mechanics of sorting out the problems these people had.
When did investment get to the top of your pile, and how did your philosophy around investment develop through that?
I was very deeply influenced by that apprenticeship in England. So I eventually moved more and more from the clerical side of things to the hands-on with clients, and then graduating within the funds management industry itself to selling the product. And so learning the underlying philosophies of the fund managers, et cetera, and promoting those in a comprehensive way that encourage them to invest with Anthony Gibbs, Henderson's, MLC, et cetera, Potter Warburg. And I discovered that I had some skill as a public speaker and I could influence people. But as far as actually managing money, I was never in that role. But working for quite a number of well-known fund managers in Australia, I learnt what they were doing, but I was never hands-on on that aspect. My role was to promote their investment skill to outside investors.
So come 2000... you've made that decision to go out on your own. That seems like a huge decision. Tell me more about what prompted that.
What prompted that was I was becoming less and less comfortable promoting to people the products that were on offer with the fund managers that I work for.
Why?
And as I say, it reached the stage where I'm sorry, I can no longer do this. I cannot tell them to do something that I personally would never do.
So what were they doing that you...
They were investing in managed funds, unit trusts. And I, as I say, I could no longer, in all my conscience, I could no longer tell them to do that.
What was it about unit trusts that you didn't like?
The structure. It was...
Costs?
No, the costs, well, I mean, the costs are one aspect of it, but ultimately it was the structure that tipped me over, because the trust structure is relatively inflexible, and the worst aspect of it is that a trust must, by law, distribute all income and capital gains. And the consequences of that could be quite devastating. One example is a fund that I was associated with, where my half-yearly dividends were running at around $2,000, $3,000, $4,000 half year. Then all of a sudden, out of the blue, I got an $11,500 half-yearly dividend. I got one more reasonable dividend. Then I got a $17,800 dividend. Both of those were the consequence of the fund manager turning over portfolio, realizing capital gains, and the trust had to distribute them, which meant that the unit price tanked. I received my capital back as a, quote, dividend, but it was my capital coming back. I then had to pay tax on my capital that was being paid back to me. And it just was, to me, utter madness, but that is the major flaw with the trust structure.
Its inefficiency is part of it.
Inefficiency, absolutely.
Now, tell us more about your philosophy that unit trusts you didn't like, and how did you develop your philosophy and communicate that with retail investors from 2000?
Well, at this stage, I had left the industry. So with retail investors, what I was promoting was the listed investment companies, where as a company rather than a trust structure, the company does not have to distribute realized capital gains. They can reinvest them without tax consequences for the existing investors. So there was no big payouts. The other thing was that the listed investment companies, the old-fashioned ones, and I'm talking about the likes of Whitefield, just celebrating 100 years, and a number of others, I think Argo, 70 years, AUI, 75 years, Soul Pattinson, 100 years, Australian Foundation, 90. That's the thing I enjoy most of all. And as an aside, the byproduct of my experience in England, where my favourite listed investment company has only been going for 162 years. And it has just paid its 56th consecutive dividend increase. My income since 1967 has been going up, 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 up every single year for 56 years. I like that.
We'll get into more of your investments and LICs in particular. I want to step back though, because I've started businesses. You started one. You started from the ground floor. How the heck did you make that work?
Well, when I left MLC, that was the final sort of company employment.
Yes.
When I left them and went out on my own, I was immediately asked by institutions, the banks, could I please come? I became a public speaker based on a fee. And so I was traveling all over the country presenting for the banks, the Australian Shareholders Association, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that became my career, public speaking, living off the fees that I earned doing it.
As well as your investments, obviously. Let's get into why you've advocated why you've you get into LICs. Are they your primary investment?
They are now. They were not back then, because when I was working in the industry, still working for fund managers, the likes of Peter Morgan, Anton Tagliaferro, etc., John Murray, etc., I would often, their advice, I would buy individual shares. So I left the industry owning quite a substantial number of individual shareholdings, direct. I have been unwinding those and am unwinding them faster and faster now and redirecting it all to listed investment companies.
Okay, so let's get into your overall philosophy. It's long-term. It's primarily industrials. It's steady dividend-paying companies or LICs. You don't want volatility in those dividends. You don't want them paying out dividends in full 1 year and then zero the next year. What do you look for in an investment?
With the listed investment companies, it's quite straightforward. They have a history, a long history, and that gives me the comfort, particularly the City of London, 162 years. How many staff changes have occurred in 162 years? But they have not been talking about their amazing bottom-up approach, their value approach, blah, blah. They have stuck strictly to a very simple investment goal to increase the capital over time and to produce an income stream that grows over time, full stop. That's it. And clearly, in 162 years, the staff has changed, but that specific target has been matched every single year, decade, etc. And it's that consistency that I'm looking for.
Now, you do advocate industrials primarily.
Mm-hmm.
Most investors' portfolios are filled with banks and miners in Australia, given that they are a large part of the indices. Why do you say that investors should largely stay away from them?
The banks I've got no problem with. It's purely the resources. Digging stuff out of the ground it's okay, but it's cheap and cheerful. And, I mean, to give an example, if I'd invested $100,000 in the industrials index 42 years ago, it would now be worth $2 million in price alone. The All Ords, it would have been worth 1.3, and the resources, it would have been 1.3. Now, if I reinvest the dividends over the 42 years, the $100,000 in industrials becomes $15 million. The All Ords gives me 8.3 million and the resources gives me 5.2 million. Digging stuff out of the ground is not what I consider to be a great investment. It is the value add from the technological, the manufacturing, and the intellectual inputs that occur within in quality industrial companies that make all the difference.
You invest in primarily LICs. Do you still have holdings in directly in companies?
I do. As I say, there's that leftover, which I'm gradually unwinding. The ultimate aim is that I will probably end up with maybe 5 or 6 listed investment companies covering that will be the total portfolio. Because if anything happens to me, I do not want my wife to inherit a portfolio of 50, 60 direct companies and all the associated hash. She will inherit 6, 7 listed investment companies and the dividend stream will continue throughout the rest of her lifetime and beyond.
Do you advocate that investors hold on to their investments? They don't sell even if markets take a big tumble?
Well, if markets take a big tumble, the last thing you do is sell, wouldn't you? But I say that with a smile on my face because, to be honest, fear is based on ignorance. knowledge is power. If you are frightened, and this is something that's annoyed me for decades, volatility has nothing to do with risk. Volatility is merely a function of the liquidity. Why was it during the GFC that a whole load of people sold their Commonwealth Bank shares and they went from $64 to $26? Are you telling me the Commonwealth Bank lost more than half its business? No, sorry.
So what should investors focus on? CBA drops, as you say. What should they focus on? Should they focus on the dividend? How do you get around that from an investor point of view? How do you stay focused?
It's very hard. It's almost impossible. Every day, the media has commentary on individual companies. Can you tell me how often the media talk about the dividends? They only are paid twice a year. Share prices are fluctuating every single day. So there's a whole lot of useless information being pumped into people's faces. Turn the television off and focus on the important things in your life, your family, your career, and friends. People are becoming slaves to their money. Money is my slave. It's out in the back room doing all the work, and I'm at the front of the house having all the fun.
I imagine some people would find that difficult. They may not have the psychological makeup to to do that. Is that key in this kind of philosophy?
So, yes. And if you don't have the willpower to be able to absorb all the media commentary, you can't switch it off mentally, then you're going to have one hell of a life. You're going to be spending an awful lot of your time worrying about something in the background when you should be focused entirely on your family, career, and friends.
With the LICs, you've mentioned a number of them there. Can you go through a few of them just to give us some examples of why you like them?
The best example is the recent COVID smash, if you like, where a lot of companies, individual companies, because of the sheer uncertainty, reduced their dividends. Some companies cancelled their dividends for a period of time until sanity returned and the fear began to drift away. But during that period, the listed investment companies were able to use their retained profits to help stabilize the dividends. And it's that element that I love. And it just, as I say, listed investment company around for 162 years, 56 years of unbroken dividend growth. I love it. It's very simple. I don't worry about a thing. In fact, I was interviewed after the global financial crisis and the interviewer asked me, you know, what was on my wish list. And I said, oh, another global financial crisis, please. And there was hesitation. He said, but Peter, why would you want another global financial crisis? I said, oh, I'd like to buy some more Commonwealth Bank at $26 because I didn't go hard enough the first time round.
What would you advocate an investor do? Say they were starting off now with a portfolio. How should they go about buying LICs on the ASX? Should they wait for discounts, average in? What would you advocate?
If they're uncertain, dollar cost average. So if you've got $20,000, depending on how frightened you are, dribble it in at $2,000 every 3 months or something like that. That way you can congratulate yourself. When you bought up here, you keep quiet about when you bought down there, then up, then down, then up, then down, then up, then down. I mean, it's a pity that would even be an element in their consideration. But unfortunately, as we've already discussed, different different strokes for different folks, and depending on their attitude towards the market and its volatility, I've never been particularly fussed. Over the decades, I can honestly say, I bought high, I bought low, I bought high, I bought low, I bought... But if you take the line of best fit between all those high lows, guess where the line's gone? Upwards for 40-plus years.
You've got quite the investor following, and I assume that you've been able to get through to these people your philosophy, and the others have kind of fallen by the wayside, the ones that aren't psychologically adept at implementing your philosophy.
Absolutely.
Is that a fair description?
Absolutely. And after 30, 40 years of presenting, I can say the feedback from thousands of presentations, my best guess is 10% of the audience intuitively get it and act. 80% enjoyed the presentation and do nothing. The other 10% go away absolutely devastated because I've just run the sword through whatever fancy investments their family had been put through. I've actually had people walk out. So I'm there for the 10%. I'm sorry, but all the rest, if they're not up to it, that's cool. I'm there for the 10%.
And tell us, how do investors get to know more of what you tell them? As in, let's promote, you've got a book out.
Yes.
You do regular seminars. Tell us more about that.
I think I mentioned, the book was a byproduct of a couple of the guys that worked for me at MLC when I decided to leave. They said, Peter, you've got to write a book. Having failed English at high school, that was a big task ahead of me. But I put the book together. I decided to self-publish rather than go through a publisher because the publisher takes 90%, leaves the author with 10%. So I thought, damn it, I'll either end up with an awful lot of doorstops or it'll go. As it turned out, it went. And the first print run disappeared, so I've updated, that sold out, I updated, that sold. So I'm now looking at 70,000 copies sold, and they're not in, it's not in any bookshops. So the demand is there. I have a newsletter, which is very infrequent. I only write when I feel I have something to say to the best extent possible.
All right, we'll leave it there, and thanks very much for your time, Peter.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That was investment consultant, author, and speaker Peter Thornhill. And it brings an end to this week's Wealth of Experience podcast. Feel free to leave any comments or feedback you may have on the podcast. And if you'd like to learn more about the topics discussed today, check out morningstar.com.au and our associated First Links and Your Money Weekly newsletters. We will be back in a fortnight. Bye for now, and happy investing.